career.
Cool.
So, you know, 27 years of experience, there's not much I haven't seen or heard of. And a lot of people that are getting involved tend to want to get involved with small projects because they want to learn, when the reality is oftentimes smaller projects are harder.
Oh, I agree. I've done probably not big by your standards, but we still have an 83-unit apartment, and it's a lot easier to own than a triplex that I bought 7 years ago. So, yeah,
totally agree. Yeah.
Totally. Okay, agree. Cool. Cool. Yeah, I definitely want to hear more about the coaching class, and we'll get there. So, all right. Well, if you're good, we'll jump into it. We tend to run roughly 45 minutes. I mean, sometimes we hit an hour, sometimes we're shorter. But usually I start to kind of hard cut it if we start to get near an hour. Do you have a problem with talking about a deal breakdown?
No.
I'll say, how'd you find it, fund it, fix it, exit, lesson. And I'll repeat all that stuff, but right. Find it, fund it, fix it, exit. Okay. So cool. Some people are like, hang on. No, I'm not talking about a live deal. Cool. Well, let's jump right into it. I know you're a pro. I saw your bio. You've been on some great platforms. So congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. I have more, respect for what that takes than I probably did 2 years ago.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is the Yield Coach Show, episode 52. I'm your host, Ian Brown. Every episode, we bring you dynamic entrepreneurs, real estate investors, thought leaders, and inspirational guests ready to open up, share their story, the good, the bad, the ugly, so you can learn lessons, gain advantages, and accelerate your own success. Very excited today to be joined by our special guest, Shannon Robnett. I have a brief bio, but we're going to learn more about him. Shannon has been in development for over 27 years as a developer investor. He completed over $425 million, and we'll find out if that's growing, $425 million in construction over pretty much every commercial asset class you can imagine. He is from the distant land of Boise, Idaho, for my Jacksonville, Florida listeners, and he is host of the Robnett's Real Estate Rundown. Welcome, Shannon.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Oh, of course. I really enjoy having developers on because for a variety of reasons, but you know, I myself have been more of a rehabber, moved into commercial and multifamily, some industrial. But it's a different animal, bringing things totally out of the ground, starting with greenfields. And, I think that's exciting. So I think you're going to bring a unique perspective, but before we jump into all that, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, you know, Ian, I grew up in a real estate family. My mother was a third generation, realtor. My father was a builder developer, with no former family experience. And I found myself, you know, and I even told this to Robert Kiyosaki, one of the times when I was speaking with him, that I found his little purple book very unimpressive, because what I didn't realize at the time, I was raised by poor dad. I was raised by, you know, in between comments of pass the mashed potatoes and dang honey, that was really good, was, you know, conversations about the Smiths want to relocate their shop and they are looking for a place. Could we build on that lot we have, and 1031s and all the things that go on in between that? And so I grew up thinking that was normal, you know, and I didn't realize how extraordinary my upbringing was until I decided I was going to be smarter than everybody else and go to college. And, in 93, joined this movement of computer information systems, only to find out that college definitely wasn't for me and it wasn't going to be a career path. So I bounced back out, began to build single family homes, found that I didn't like homeowners. The bitching factor was too high. The reward was too low and it wasn't really scalable. And so I got into commercial. We've done everything from police stations to fire stations, gymnasiums, schools, city halls, medical facilities, ambulatory facilities, all that kind of stuff. And I realized that when I was done building for other people, so was my paycheck. I couldn't keep going back to the well for things that weren't there. But these owners of these buildings were able to do that. They were able to collect rents. They were doing a lot less work than I was, and they were getting paid every single month. And so at about that same time, I watched my parents retire with cash flow at 50 years old, and that meant that all their bills were paid. And all their spending money came from their assets and their hard work that they'd done years ago. And, so I built my first industrial project, as an investment in 2001. And, I still have two of the original tenants in that building, and that's continued to take care of itself. because honestly, Ian, where are you going to make gelato ice cream on a commercial scale, right? And so, you know, I saw the value of that. And so then I began to partner with other people, maybe a guy here that could write a check for $1 million and we do a deal. And that scale continued to grow in 2017. I embarked on my last single person partnership with a family office on 180 units of ground up development. We sold that last year for $64 million. And I realized very quickly that the scale at which I was going was outpacing what I was able to find a person willing to write a check on. And at about the same time, I was introduced to a guy that grew up in the movie industry and showed me how to syndicate capital. So as you can hear already in my story, nothing I did was normal, right? I didn't go to college and get a construction management degree and get into construction. I just kind of came by it naturally, through osmosis and genetics. But I found myself attracted to that model. And over the last 3.5 years, we've been able to generate a raise about $58 million in capital that we've used in various projects, including, ground up development and, value add projects in both the multifamily and the industrial world. And so that's kind of what gets me to where I'm at today.
A lot there, Shannon, and thank you. That's awesome. Congrats on the disposition you had. Now on the family, watching your family retire, your parents retire in their 50s, was that, I assume their portfolio looked a little different. Was it single family?
No, it was industrial.
Oh, it was industrial. Yeah. Okay. So that's why you're saying you broke the mold right out of the gates, like you didn't go the construction management route. Now I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I just followed in the family footsteps and, you know, we didn't build anything really complicated for a long time, but as my skill set grew and as my staff grew, you know, we got into very complicated projects and, you know, medical build outs are definitely among the hardest.
All right. So we know how you ended up going, I'll call it non-residential, and that's been my core background. I'm a certified general appraiser. That was the first designation I got. And we had to do whatever the bank wanted,
right.
Office, retail, industrial, hospitality, golf course, marina, whatever. So I've been very comfortable in all kinds of profit and loss statements and running valuation. What's interesting is in this kind of thought leadership world that, we're both in or we get in and out of, there's a lot of people talking about the value of multifamily. Well, let's play devil's advocate since I have you right here on the interview. What do you see as, the cons of multifamily? Given that it's probably, I would argue, depending on what media channels you follow, you're probably hearing about multifamily 10-1 versus other asset classes. What do you see as some of the potential cons of multifamily?
Well, I see a lot of cons to multifamily when you compare it to something as simple and often overlooked as industrial. So let's talk about the tenants in multifamily. You've got somebody that probably doesn't have a great credit score. That's why they're renting. Probably doesn't have much as far as the way of assets and or financials. That's also why he's renting. They don't tend to stick, right? They maybe 2 years. They want to be within a 5-mile radius of where they work or whatever. They have very specific reasons why they're there. And they will leave you for $35, right? I mean, literally they will pack their stuff in the middle of the night and depart for $35 in a rent raise. The other con with multifamily is you can't necessarily pass on your expenses to the tenant. So now let's flip over to how that correlates with industrial. Industrial tenants are usually businesses. Well, they're always businesses, and they're usually backed by a balance sheet. The owner owns their own home. They've got good credit. They've got some sort of backing enough that allows them to function as a business, to have employees, to do those kinds of things. Number two, they always sign personal guarantees. Number three, they sign long-term leases. So an industrial lease is typically 5 to 10 years. And lastly, and I think the one that is absolutely the most important, especially considering where you're at right now and what's getting ready to happen, is all of the expenses are a direct cost to the tenant. They're not absorbed in your lease. And so as a lot of multifamily operators are finding out this year with insurance going nuts, with property valuations being assessed at what things sold for in the bubble of 21, you're seeing a lot of property taxes and insurance skyrocket, with really no way to pass that on to the tenant until rents rise in the area. In a triple net lease or an industrial lease, when you lock in a long-term lease like that, the benefit is we say that here are the expenses operating the building and here's the rent. And we as the landlord will charge you a pro rata of that each month for the expenses, and you will reimburse us. And annually, we will do an adjustment based on what our actual expenses were versus our estimate. So every year, by the end of February, I am net zero on my expenses on that particular project for last year. The tenant paid me, let's call it $1 a foot in rent. So I got that as my true rent. All of the expenses are his issue. So as we see property taxes and insurance skyrocket, even lawn care has gone up substantially because of labor costs, we're unfazed. Our return is our return. The last thing is, when you look at what industrial trades at, they're typically 1.5 to 2% higher on cap rates, which means out of the gate, you're getting better cash flow than you are on a multifamily. And while there's not as much potential for upside, well, today you can see there's not as much potential for downside.
That was a really good answer, Shannon. And for those that don't understand what Shannon, the triple net lease structure, it's all the pass-through expenses is another way to say it. So your tenant is going to pick up all expenses. And in a true triple net, they're going to pick up taxes, insurance, common area maintenance, all interior and exterior, plumbing, HVAC, electric, everything. And a true
including property management. Including property management, right?
You're going to pay the bill for those that are managing.
That's right. Yes. That's right. So the bigger pain in the butt you've got, the more property management you have to get involved, the more it costs them, not me.
So when you go, and some people are going to know this, some people are not, but when you go and you look at commercial rent and you compare apples to apples, you're going to look at that CAM or that tie CAM or those triple nets, a few different words for the same thing. And that's how you play apples to apples. But it is not uncommon, at least in my market, for, let's say I'm using very round numbers. Let's say you get quoted a triple net of $20 a foot for, we actually have some light industrial at 20 a foot around here. And you might have triple nets, maybe not 10, but they're going to be in the high single digits. So you need to know all of that extra triple net cost, those pass-throughs. That's the landlord insulating himself, as Shannon said, from all of those expenses, those hiccups that what have you along the way. So you know your NOI, calculating NOI on a triple net deal is an easy and beautiful thing, isn't it, Shannon?
It is. It really is. And, you know, financing is often easier on it, too, because you're not looking at lease expirations, right? Sometimes you get dinged when you go to the bank and you've got a lot of lease expirations in August and you're trying to finance it in September and you're running into some unknowns, right? And so one of the things that we find about it is while it's not been the darling child, and you're right, it's not mentioned 10 to 1, but the demand is just as high for new product and more product, and vacancy rates are similar. The other thing that I see with it is, you know, we're mid-stroke on a project right now that we've got an international tenant, publicly traded company that has signed a 10-year lease with 3 10-year extensions. So I have a tenant that likely will be there for 40 years. Now, when you think about what it takes for you and me and a couple of pickup trucks to empty an apartment, versus what an international stone dealer's got to do to clear out a 40,000 square foot warehouse and move their business operations and change their clients' buying habits and where they come for that, and all of the expenses involved in that, there's really a very unlikely chance that they're going to move unless their business model changes very, very substantially. So the reality is we do have a steady product. We do have a very it's a very boring product, you know. We just don't get the issues or the excitement of upswings in the market. You know, we saw cap rate compression by comparison in multifamily go from what, mid fives in 18 to somewhere in the high twos to low threes, where in industrial we saw compression go from 7 to 5.75, right? So we saw similar compression, not quite as much, but really a 5.75 cap means that you're getting about a 6% cash on cash day one on the product. So why would you chase a 2.5 cap?
Right. And as we both know, interest rates got so low, they're kind of playing that arbitrage game, you know, get a couple hundred basis points between your underlying mortgage and whatever you can do on that cash flow, driving everything down. I mean, it was like you could get, I feel like everything in Florida, it was hard to find anything stabilized under 6 cap, 7 if it's a little beat up. And like you said, any of the A-class stuff, forget about it. You know, I have been I started in multifamily. I did a few different things, but I started personally investing in multifamily, and I opened this door earlier. I'm not anti-multifamily. I'm just anti-multifamily the way people are doing it now.
Right.
Razor thin margins. I'm going to say something that's not about controversial, but you can get money to do multifamily. So what does that mean?
People do multifamily.
You have governmental backed agency financing up to very, very, very high check amounts. You also have I'll call it the investor class of America, your average accredited investor, or family office or wherever you go, or private equity. They've already heard the spiel about multifamily for so long. It's a pretty quick discussion. So the fact that the banks still want to lend on it, all of your forms of private capital are pretty well versed in it. If you're a fund manager or a syndicator, it's still somewhere where you can generate fees, try to make minor improvements, pray for an exit, fix your debt. I like to see more movement. I like to see more margin. I lost the appetite with the way things have been going. And so I thought it was fun back when we were buying, this is going to sound like I'm lying, but we were buying, I bought 83 units for $11,000 a door. An hour and a half from my house, and they quickly went to 60 a door. But, that's an extreme example, but finding things around my market in the 20s and 30s and 40s a door, if you cold called and you worked and you networked, you could do it. It's not even attainable anymore. And people will buy with negative leverage and just wait.
And, Ian, that's where I see, I really agree with you on this point, because it's almost like people have treated multifamily, like day trading. We're going to buy this. We hope everything works. If everything works, we're going to exit. But they've never, I think a lot of those people haven't been through cycles. They haven't been through downturns. They haven't been through cap rate escalating as quickly as it compressed. And so now those same people are finding themselves in negative leverage positions, looking at, maybe they went with bridge debt and it's needing to refinance or turn over at this point, and they're finding themselves in cash call situations where they can't even pay off the bank note. I mean, there's a lot there that happens that really comes down to education and underwriting. I've been doing this for 27 years. I've been hit by every bust that's out there. I often tell people I've got a dollar for every mistake I ever made, because it was the mistakes that have taught me how to really go about making money. And people that have got involved in 18, 19, and 20 really haven't lived in a real estate world. They've lived in a hyperinflated bubble that has been, definitely accelerated by cheap capital. And I think that if people really sat down and did a pros and cons like you and I just did on what do you want the asset class to do for you, most of my investors love, I mean, I don't know any investor that doesn't love strong returns, right? But most of my investors don't want to be exiting deals in 18 to 30 months. They want to be able to do, they want to be able to put their money to work, know that they're going to be getting returns on a regular basis per the pro forma, but they don't want to have to be having conversations with me every 12 to 18 months as we're looking at exiting something. And now we've got to deal with tax consequences. We've got to do other things. The thing is, real estate really should be viewed, in my opinion, as a long-term strategy for both cash flow and tax abatement, right? And when the way that the majority of people have been playing the Monopoly game lately is like fix and flippers. And it's not awesome for the investor. I mean, it's fantastic to make $100,000 in 2 years on your $100,000 investment. Nobody's going to be mad about that. But then you're slicing off $35,000 for Uncle Sam, $25,000 for Uncle Sam. Then you got to scramble and find another investment. And then what do you do there? And, it's interrupting of your cash flow because you just came out of a deal that, while they were turning units and increasing value by increasing rents, there wasn't a ton of cash flow because they were implementing a strategy to improve the units. And so the guy that wanted the cash flow was just starting to get his cash flow, and you went and screwed it up by selling it. So when I look at it, I have a whole different philosophy. And, I was talking with somebody the other day, and they go, that's a young man's game. That's a lot of frickin' work. Whereas the buy and hold, you look back on it, there's a lot of people that sold apartments in 2019 that really wish they had them in 21 would still be okay at today's pricing and are going to regret enormously not owning them in 27, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really where, you know, I've sold one asset to a REIT. They look at everything through a 20-year lens, right? They're looking for adequate cash flow today. They're looking at a 20-year lens to make a 5X on their money, right? And that's not really outrageous, but when you're looking at a 5X return, that's nice and little or no effort, right? I mean, you bought it one time and you put it with a third party management company and it continued to produce.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I love the whole, you know, gravitating towards the vanilla, the boring, if you will. That's where I'm gravitating as well.
I mean, Ian, if you want excitement in your life, go skydiving, you know? I mean, go pick somebody to have a duel with. I mean, you know, excitement can be found, but get it on your terms. Don't, you know, but we've seen a lot of people get into this frenzy and it hasn't been good for the market, in my opinion.
Go skydiving for your excitement. Yeah. I agree. And what's interesting is we're ramping up for probably our most vanilla endeavor we've had in a while, but I'm really excited about it. I don't know how it looks in Boise where you are, where you invest, but we have a major undersupply of open storage. So light mm-hmm. industrial, boat, RV, trailers,
yep.
oversized vehicles. In Jacksonville, our zoning is kind of funny. If you want to put like an 18 wheeler, depending on it's the cab or the trailer, sometimes you need some special zoning. But for the purpose of this podcast, we're looking for uncovered fenced stable storage yards. And we have a proliferation of housing units, thousands and thousands and thousands of subdivisions in the pipeline, our units, not subdivisions, but we have a lot of units coming on and almost none of them build with the ability to park these oversized vehicles in your driveway. Yeah. And then they don't build, let's say 2, 3, 4, 5 acres within the development because you'd rather just sell off the lots for some kind of storage. I've seen it once, right. in the past few years watching them. So you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Talk about a bare knuckle Neanderthal blocking and tackling kind of deal.
Oh,
we're looking to aggregate 100 acres of open storage throughout our greater Jacksonville market, get it under common marketing, common management, common software, common everything, and roll it up to private equity REIT buyout or just hang on and refi. But talk about vanilla. I mean, I'm really excited about it, but you tell it to some people and they're like, are you just talking about like yards, dirt, gravel, fence,
yep.
park?
Yep.
I'm like, yes, I am.
And in doing all that, you're going to put a kiosk out front. They're going to enter their credit card. They're going to have a monthly billing. They're going to have an access code. You don't even have a staff other than to manage the weeds. And the reality is you're probably going to be very low leverage because you're really essentially financing land. So you're going to be low leverage. You're going to be a beautiful, beautiful investment because there's not a lot of moving parts, but some people have gotten the idea that, and I honestly think it's because of ignorance, right? Stupidity is if you repeat ignorance, right? But if you don't understand how this works and how stable that is and what stability looks like, especially in economies like this. I mean, think about this. You're trying to man an apartment complex with staff and nobody wants to work. You don't care in your business model that you just discussed because you have a kiosk there that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, plugs into your software. You take credit cards, right? If they don't pay, they can't get access to the vehicle. It's really, really simple. You don't even have to be the enforcer. You just inbound, right? And yet you've got all these other moving parts. You've got paint. You've got dishwashers. You've got washers and dryers. You've got roofs. You've got all this stuff in multifamily and also in industrial that is just not there, that the simplicity is the beauty. The simplicity is where it's pure cash flow because there aren't moving parts and there aren't things that break down and there aren't miscommunications. And it's not you've eliminated 90% of the potential for disaster. And mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people fail to look at, Ian, is the time value of money, right? Every year at the end of the year, I take my tax return. I divide it by 52 weeks and I divide it by 40 hours a week. And that is my billable rate that I put in my head and I approach my year with. How many people spend mountains of time dealing with property management companies, dealing with accountants, dealing with all the vendors and all the things and say that they made $100,000 and they spent 1,000 hours at it, right? Well, where was your paycheck? Where was this? What I'm hearing you say, you might have to swing out there and put more tape in the receipt printer. Oh, you taxed and vexed man.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's funny because I started at the other end of the spectrum, largely because, I personally, in the very, very beginning, I wanted to do it on my own. So if I failed, it was just me. So what did I do? I did what a lot of bigger pockets listeners might do. And I flipped a little purple house in a transient neighborhood and, it worked out and, you know, it was fine. I did not do another one of those.
Yeah. But that's my comment of every dollar I have, I got from a mistake because I moved a house. I bought a house for $5,000, moved it 1 mile down the road, put it on a basement, and I've never done another remodel again in my life, right? But I learned from that. I don't think I made any money on that, but I also am not wasting my time doing remodels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's where multifamily has its allure because they do exactly what you and I did. They do that, then they go from a lot of times they start with wholesaling because they don't have any cash, right? And that's a great step because that's probably the hardest job in the business. Then you go to fix and flip. Then you go to the BRRRR strategy. Then you go to multifamily. And when you look at the majority of BlackRocks and REITs in the world, you know, BlackRock just got involved in multifamily a couple years ago. They were not in that asset class by and large while they owned mountains of office and industrial. But they look at where the effort has to go for the cash to flow, and they just couldn't make it work. Now we'll see.
So I want to pivot just a little bit. You're a unique guest. We've talked about kind of the pros and cons of multifamily, and you've done really well for yourself. I think we had not hit record yet, but I think you mentioned before we started that you have a tenant from something you built back in 01 that hasn't left, right? Just
that's
as
right.
An example of these sticky tenants yes.
That tenant, that business has sold three times, right? I mean, it's a gelato company, right? The guy shows up on Wednesday. He makes all his different gelato ice creams. He puts them in the walk-in freezer. He comes back on Friday. He loads them into the same van they bought new in 2001, and he delivers them to restaurants. You can't put that in a garage, right? So the only thing that's going to happen is he's going to need to make more ice cream in order to move out of that space. So when the business sold, the van sold, I mean, I still drive by the building and I laugh because there's this 2001 Ford Astro van or whatever it is, little, you know, looks like it's just a minivan, and he loads all his ice cream up in the coolers that he's retrofitted it with. And that's continued to sell with the business. And that is truly the stickiness of that business.
I have a colleague, an industrial broker here in town, and we're also business partners on a few things. And he had a governmental tenant put $16 million in specialized build out into one of his industrial buildings. And he's like, talk about a sticky tenant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You get a build out. I mean, and as you know, a lot of us think of just a concrete box or a steel box, small office. And yes, sometimes that's what it is. But sometimes there is such sophisticated trade equipment and build out. It is cost prohibitive. You said you might lose the multifamily tenant over the $35 rent bump. I mean, if somebody has millions of dollars in build out in a specialized configuration, they're not relocating that on a rent bump.
No, exactly. And you know, that is where the patient money resides. You know, it hangs out there and it goes, hey, in 5 years, I'm going to bump his rent to 10% above market and there's nothing he's going to do, you know? And so I completely agree with you on a lot of the topics you've brought up.
Well, let's talk about development. You're an interesting guest with a 27-year development background. You've done some governmental projects, like you mentioned earlier, like municipal jobs, but let's talk about kind of the evolution of your development background. And, obviously you prefer development over trying to rehab things. So let's start there.
Yeah. So the very first deal I ever did was actually a rezone, and I was working on a job for my dad, and we were building an industrial warehouse for a company. And my crane operator was complaining that, you know, he needed to find a yard, you know, needed 3 acres, and hell, he'd even take one with an old house on it so he could put his office in there. Meanwhile, I got to know the neighbor lady next door. She was in her 70s and had a mentally disabled son, and they were looking to move out of this old nasty house, because she knew that in the next 5 or 7 years, she was going to become incapacitated. He wasn't able to take care of her. So they were looking for a nursing facility to move to. I put two and two together, and Ian, I didn't put my last $500 down as an earnest money because I only had 500. So I put all my money in on the earnest money on this thing, and I essentially did a simultaneous close. I negotiated that there was going to be some improvements on the land. Those were held in escrow, so we were able to close on the land, do the improvements. That guy is still there today. But I saw how rezoning something or changing uses or envisioning it the way that the city did increased a lot of value. And, you know, it increased timelines as well. But, you know, a typical deal for us is we identify a site that works in a market that we already like and we've underwritten. We go in and we put together a PSA with the owner that says, you know what, because this is the deal that every owner sees in their land. They see the vision of what it can be. And they don't want to let go of the price of what it would be for entitled dirt. So after, you know, time on the market or several runs at them that says, hey, you know what? By the way, in your current condition, it's only worth $25,000 a door. I can't give you the 35 you're looking for. We come in and we write a PSA that's contingent. We will pursue development. Here's our schedule of when we'll submit to the city, have our meetings, do our things, create our drawings, all of this kind of stuff. And we will pay you that amount of money 60 days after we receive conditional or final approval from the city entities. And so then they say, well, that all sounds good. How long is that going to take? Well, hopefully it's going to take 6 months. It never does. The cities are always late. We're always, you know, we're there with our schedules. But then we write that with a earnest money of usually $500,000. That's a promissory note because I don't want to tie up $500,000 in escrow for a year and a half, right? So you've got a promissory note that converts to, real cash 5 days after city approvals and closing within 60. And so we're able to do that. So we really have very little in it other than our go forward costs of getting with the city and doing all that. And then once we have the land entitled, we're able to then bring in our investors and close on the property. So we really have go forward costs of, you know, the last deal we did was 190 unit apartment complex. We probably had $215,000 into that with plans and everything. And so we were able to do that on an $80 million project with very, very little in. And I didn't run into any of these issues that investors or that GPs ran into in 2021, where it was $1 million non-refundable earnest money day one, right? I had time to do soils reports. I had time to meet with the cities. I had time to do all this stuff. And if at any point none of that worked out, I got my promissory note back and I was out some costs. So we've been able to kind of perfect that a little bit to slow down the process. And then to your point, Ian, I've got projects that are on my board for 12 months from now that I know I'm going to be raising money for. So when I'm having conversations with people, I can be talking about something that's coming up in 6 months when their money's going to be available. You know, how many times have you had a conversation with a guy that says, man, I really like what you're doing. What are you going to have in 6 months? And the typical general partner that's doing value add multifamily says, God, I have no idea, right? We're able to sit there and go, you know what? Here's our schedule of what's coming down the pipe. And we also have the time to educate our investors of what's coming down the pipe and why they would be interested in it. And so we don't run into that feeding frenzy of everybody wanting only multifamily in the Houston market, in the C class, whatever they, you know, we're able to say, hey, we're doing a deal in Florida that is, you know, for an international stone dealer, it's a triple net deal. It's this. And we've given that education over the last 6 months and now the project's ready to go and everybody's heard about it. Right. And so it's a very different model and it's for the contractor because it's slower. You know, most of us contractors aren't really that bright. We just play that way, right, in front of people. But the reality is we're able to go, so we're able to do it right.
Oh, you're plenty bright, Shannon. And I'm just trending. It's funny. I'm not a ground-up developer. My background is appraisal, brokerage, and legal.
Right.
But it's funny. My mindset is actually way more aligned with yours than you might think. So, like,
I'm hearing it.
I already told you where I'm trending with our upcoming fund. And it's like to hear, and I sit on Jacksonville's planning commission, 4 years of being a planning commissioner, rezones, everything. So I see it and I love the bare knuckle, slow human side, because think about when most people make errors, they're rushed. They didn't have time to figure it out. They had to make an assumption. It was close. Their underwriting was almost there. I think it's going to be this. Let's go. And that's where you get hurt. And what's beautiful about what you just described, you got 6 months. You have 6 months for your entitlement. And you're right. It probably is going to be slightly more. And in that time, it's not like you're only doing entitlement stuff. You're running your numbers any way you want. You can try and kill your deal, sink your deal, see if it can still float. I mean, the odds of you have time to watch the macro. You can look at everything. You walk every property. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible to make a mistake when you move that slowly, but your odds go way, 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 way down.
Well, the other thing too, Ian, we've got to deal with people like you, right? We've got to deal with appraisers. I mean, we can't just make this stuff up and pencil whip our spreadsheets to say what we want them to say or have everybody in and on. Yeah, exactly. You know, but we're taking that to the level that we've got to be able to back this up. And as you know, I can project to you that we can sell at a 4 cap, right? And I may be able to prove that case to you. But when you involve an appraiser, the appraiser is going to tell the bank the truth or a much more achievable number. And so when we come back, our underwriting has always been very, very conservative because I like it when the appraiser says, you know what? I think you can get a 5.5 cap on this. And Shannon said a 6. The banker goes, this guy knows what he's doing, right? And my investors look at that. And then when I'm able to come back and say, you know what, guys, this is so cool. This is so awesome. The appraiser said 87 million. We said 80. Aren't we going to be in fantastic shape? You know, and we did that with our last ground up deal. It's a 60 unit apartment complex that's nearing completion. We were shooting for an $18 million exit. Our appraisal in November of 22 came in at 23 million, right? So anywhere over 18, my investors are stoked. The fact that when all of this stuff is coming out in the news right now, my investors have that silver lining that 18 million shouldn't be that difficult. We've seen shrinkage in cap rates in sales prices, but we haven't seen that much. There's a lot less of this angst with the group, you know, and they're true appreciation deals because you're able to really take the sticks and stones and build something and then add the tenant and really add the value that you're not taking somebody else's purple people eater and change it into something else by throwing new chairs by the pool and a new sign out front.
Yeah. Well, especially if you're entitling land and then literally, so you'd say you take some ag property or some office or something and you rezone it light industrial and you build one of your projects or one of these big triple net international granite guys. I mean, so many reasons that's a solid move. Now, you mentioned something, it might have been before we went live, but so what you're doing would outpace a lot of guys and gals' capital raising ability. And you might have mentioned it earlier where it's like your projects are getting so big. It's like you had to kind of figure out the funding side, the syndicating side of some of these larger development projects. Can we pivot a little bit into how to keep your capital raising caught up with these large, ambitious developments?
Well, and I think the reason that I have that is I did everything in reverse, right? So I have a lot of real world experience and not a lot of capital raising experience, right? And so what I'm able to convey to people is that I've been in the trench. I've done the deals. I'm, you know, here's my history that a lot of capital raisers struggle with. They can't tell you what they did last, what they exited. I can point to a building that I did in 1999, right? And I can show you what we built it for, and I can show you what it rented for then. And so when people look at this, and this is where I think, again, the 2020-21 bubble was made worse because a lot of people were getting into that frenzy of raising capital without having the true implementation knowledge. They didn't have the ability to operate. They didn't have the ability to truly troubleshoot and make these projects truly, truly work, right? You're putting lipstick on a pig and you're selling it to somebody else. And at some point that music stops, right? You bought a deal. But when you're really looking at it, people want to go fast. And I don't think that's a great idea because it's not that I'm not having, implications to, you know, what happened with COVID for supply chain. I'm having implications. Things happen that are interest rate related. All of those things still affect me, but I'm 27 years deep and only $57 million raised. So if you look at my average per year, I've only raised about $2 million a year, and there's a lot of these syndicators out there that have figured out how to raise $10, $15, $20 million a year and have gotten into projects that their skill set doesn't back up. And so when I look at that, I tell people all the time, don't get in a hurry to get yourself in a jam. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, really understand, you know, a lot of people don't get it. But I mean, I literally treat my investors' money as more sacred than my own, right? I will lose my money hands down all day long rather than take the option and opportunity to lose my investors' money. And that's why we do all of the entitlements before our investors get involved. But the reality is when people look at that and they go, well, I want to raise more capital, I want to raise more capital, I would tell you to look at your experience, because the experience is what tells investors in troubled times like right now what horses they're betting on. Mm-hmm. And if you've got the depth in your bench, if you've got the resume that says that you've done it, if you've got the not only the exits but the management of assets during uncertain times, you're not going to have near the problem raising capital that those that are real thin on their resume, it takes seven guys to pull $2 million, you know, those kinds of things where you need to be more patient, in my opinion.
I would agree with that. I've been working on the capital raising side just in the past probably 6 to 10 months and trying to be more systematic. Part of why we're moving on the next structure is to have a 18 to 20 month cycle where you can bring on capital and bring in deals. And to your point, so I'm around some other, let's call it maybe more green, aspiring capital raisers that did not come from what I would consider a traditional real estate or commercial real estate background, which we both have more traditional real estate backgrounds from different sectors. Mine's more like underwriting deals and law, and you're bringing the stuff out of the ground, which is not my forte. So, but what's interesting, we can at least both have war stories. I got 17 years. You got 27 years. I mean, I got a glimpse of the go-go days and then the fall and then the, and then this long steady rise and you got a whole nother cycle. And so, but what I'm getting at is I see some people that are so eager to have like the best capital raising platform and the best systems. And I kind of cringe to think like, what if somebody actually wrote them a really big check? Cause some of these people, like the look, the speak, the branding actually looks pretty good. I mean, honestly, a lot of it looks better than mine, but I know that I'm going to be a good steward of money. You've been a good steward of money, and I've done deals and projects, underwritten a bajillion of them. And I'm like, well, what if this guy actually gets someone to give him $5 million, $10 million bucks, whatever it is. I'm like, and I think you've heard the term like fund to funds, where it's like you're taking the money and you're going to someone like yourself. And hey, nothing against fund to funds, but think about like the righteous responsibility you have.
Yeah.
Now you're the custodian of this big pool of other people's money. And you have to, like you said, I think you said pick the right horse. You have to now pick the right operator, the right horse to put the money in. And most of these arrangements, the fund to funds guy, at best, he might have a seat like at the asset management table that isn't even, it can't even.
But he's not a shot caller.
He's not a shot caller.
You know,
so you know where I'm going with this. It's it's beyond a little concerning at times when I'm like, well, I see it as a recipe for potential disaster when you have somebody who's just like a charismatic communicator who's really a good salesperson. And I don't I respect salespeople, but
absolutely,
if they aggregate a bunch of money and what they're selling is somebody else's skill set that they're going to park the money with, but they actually don't have the acumen to underwrite the other guy's skill set.
Right.
That's inherently a problem.
Right. And I've seen that on multiple occasions already this year where people have, they've been that really great person. They've been able to get into the tech field or into, you know, pockets where they're able to aggregate $40, $60, $80, $100 million. And then what they began to believe is that they could do all this stuff themselves. And so they started doing the asset management and they started taking the deals down. And, you know, the worst thing about best and final is who's going to bleed the most, right? And so they got into these best and finals and they won. But then that's when their problem started. And now you've got a lot of operators that aren't really operators. They're salesmen, right? So they've now got this other job that they've never seen done. They've never been a part of. They've never had a seat at that table that they got to figure out. So then what happens? And then you start this whole cataclysmic thing where it begins to implode that nobody really even knows it's happening because they've never seen an implosion before. And I completely agree with you, Ian. There's going to be a lot of that fallout, which for guys like you and I, this is the thing that we do. We tell the story, right? We show what we know, right? I'm here to show you the deals that I've done. I'm here to educate you. The last thing I want you in is my deal. The first thing I want you to do is understand it. Really, actually, the first thing I want you to understand is your investment thesis. Why are you investing? What are you chasing? Are you chasing tax benefits? Are you chasing cash flow? Are you chasing appreciation? Because you really only get one as your primary, and the other two somewhere fit in there somewhere. But if you're putting the right guy in the wrong deal, you're not going to make anybody happy. But when you look at that and you educate like you are and you bring people along for the journey and you show them this is why this is a good deal, this is why this is a great asset, this is why this is solid underwriting, and then they look at it and go, wow, Ian, how did you learn that? Well, 17 years of doing A, B, and C. Wow, that's amazing. Then you're building a relationship. You're not building a one-shot investor where you've got to go chew through the pound the phones again and do this kind of stuff to get another group of investors because these guys have soured on the fact that your last deal didn't work.
And I think that, you know, as the tide goes out, well, you know, we'll see who's wearing pants and all that. But the silver lining has kind of been that employment has really not taken any hit. You know, you got little fluctuations. And so, and even during COVID, I'm not trying to go down that rabbit hole, but everybody still had, for the most part, still had money or was given money. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of think that's why crypto took off, but that's not, anyways, people wanted to be able to do something with their money and tell their friends about it. So, but my point is, you know, when I was appraising through the fall of 08 and beyond that deep downturn, I was appraising commercial, unemployment was, it was like, there goes 500,000 jobs. There goes 500. Yep. I mean, the stats were horrible. I know you remember them. And and now, I mean, we're still, I'm rounding a little bit, but we're under 4%, you know, unemployment in my area. And I've seen it drop down a little bit lower. Certain sectors, it fluctuates. But my point is right now, everyone, no one's really hurting right now. You kind of have an absence of transactions, which is kind of why I think there's more people in like the fund of funds capital raising mindset right now, because if you're just a deal guy, which I'm really a deal guy first. If you're just a deal guy, you're like, well, okay. I had a guest on who tracks every multifamily sale in the north of Orlando in the state of Florida. And it was down to like 10% transactional activity. And some counties didn't even have a sale yet. And so my point is, if you're like, well, am I still going to make it as like a deal guy operator, whether I'm a broker, a banker, or an asset, you know, if I'm an active investor, or should I go over here and try and raise capital and make some fees, spin some things around and find somewhere where I can place a lot of money because I might only be able to do it one time this year because there's such a scarcity of transactions. Right. I just tend to think there might be something there. All right. Yeah. Well, Shannon, if we could, I believe you told me before the call, you know, you've got your 27 year experience and, you know, part of how you are enriching or giving back is you've got a program where you're showing people more of the development path, which is not a commonly revealed path to real estate wealth. It is tried and true, but I would say not commonly revealed. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, what I get hit up on all the time, Ian, and you do too. Hey, let me buy you a cup of coffee and pick your brain, right? Well, like I told you earlier in the podcast, I do that math that tells me how much my time is worth. And so what I've really done is I've launched a coaching program for those that are really, really serious about upping their game. And it's really a one-on-one coaching program with me on a weekly basis to really take your game to the next level because you have specific things you want to focus on. So it's not a mastermind where we're sitting around with 300 of your closest friends that are all in different asset classes trying to find commonality. It's where you and I go one-on-one and create the maximum value for your time and the maximum application of my experience. And, you know, the reality is I found a really untapped market in that regard because there's a lot of people that are going, oh, thank God, there's finally somebody that will tell me specifically about my deal, stay focused with me on my deal, help me underwrite my deal to get to that place where, unlike all the people we just talked about for the last 10 minutes that have been swimming naked, they're actually going to be in a place where they're going to do a legit deal and they're going to get it off the ground and they're going to make it work and it's going to be successful because it's going to have all the earmarks of somebody with 25 years, 27 years of experience, right? And so that's really what I've looked at. And I thought about doing some other stuff where, you know, we're doing large classes and stuff like that. That's just not me. I really want to get to the place where, look, this isn't your first rodeo, but you're not the rodeo clown, right? And we want to really get to what we want to do and make sure that we can make your gig successful, and we can focus on, do you want to get more social media presence? Do you want to get more into development? Do you want to know really what markets to underwrite? Whatever it is you want to do in your real estate career, I'm going to go one-on-one with you, and I'm really going to help you dig into that and come up with your whole program and your whole thesis, and then show you how to scale that like I have.
I like that. And I feel, and I have participated in some that are more, like you said, 300 of your air quotes, yeah, closest friends, yeah, trying to find, yeah, commonality. And, right, and what's crazy is some of these courses are rising to a ticket price that you would assume there's one-on-one coaching or something more intimate. And, what I'll say is a lot of times it's hard to find a program like, and I don't know a whole lot about your program, but I've gotten to know you over the past hour, where someone will meet you where you are, look at, right, where you are, your age, your goals, what you've done, what you're trying to do, and give you like a granular, nuanced assessment. And
exactly.
I feel like conversely, a lot of programs are like, here's the gold standard, here's what you should shoot for, and here's the ways to get there. Well,
right,
it takes no account into where I am in life, my education, my skill set, my background. How, some of these are huge gaps. Some of them I'm, yep, very close to. So it's just not granular enough. And then I think if you just hold up a shiny object, here's where you need to be, take my course, people get lost. You know, they get in there and it's too much.
And then the other thing you've got is you've got a one size fits most underwriting, you know, section of the course, where how do you fit some of the deals that you've done in your life, Ian, into some of these spreadsheets. And if you don't understand the nuances of what you personally are dealing with, you don't know how to fit it into the spreadsheet. Well, let's go to My Underwriting People. Let's build out the spreadsheet that you want so that you can understand how to get that done. And then you know that, hey, I now also know where to get a custom written spreadsheet that makes my deal very, very simple and explainable and available to everybody.
I love it. I think that's, I can see that being underserved, because I think, as you know, and I know, I do not currently have a coaching program, but I think that a lot of people are being told to go with the one to many. We kind of know the structure, and I think that can serve some. It can move the needle some, but to really meet somebody where they are and commit to them and pour into them metaphorically, it's hard to find. Everyone's absolutely, like, everyone's like on the podcast saying, find a mentor. And then you're like, well, nobody's really offering to be like a real mentor, you know, not meet me right where I am.
And then the reality is, let's look at mentorship, right? Okay. So you want to be a mentor, but what do you have to add value? And so now you're asking somebody for years and years of their time and knowledge condensed into a cup of coffee. There comes a point when I'm going to meet with you once, but after that, it's just the equation for how that works financially for both of us isn't serving. But here's what I will tell you. When you're looking at what you get out of this, this one-on-one coaching will take your, it will give you the ability to put your skill set on par with anybody. You'll have access to the resources, the Rolodex, everything that I have available now after 27 years of aggregating it at your disposal, and you'll know how to use it. It's a very different thought process.
All right. Well, I'm sure there's somebody listening that just perked up there that's interested in development. I think that two things you're doing that are unique. It's a one-on-one focus, and it's a truly done with you. And the development angle. A lot of people are not focused on development. A lot of capital raising out there right now. A lot of multifamily out there right now. We've already talked about that. So, all right. I want to jump into what I call the Coach Brown breakdown, and let's just go real, you know, topically through a deal. Find, fun, fix, exit, and a lesson. So, you know, we'll go through a sample deal. How'd you find it? How'd you fund it? You're a developer, so you probably built it. And then how'd you exit? Was there a lesson? So step one, finding the deal. If you wouldn't mind, take us through a sample.
Well, you know, one of the deals that we could talk about, because it's over, is, you know, it was a 36-unit apartment complex. I found an old mobile home park that had been abandoned. So I had, I think, 18 sewer and water hookups, so that saved me a little bit. I bought the deal. I got it rezoned. I got the plans drawn, and we built the units. We tenantized it. We sold it. All of that happened over the course of 3.5 years, right? So it wasn't fast. So first of all, we're dealing with the city, and, you know, we're convincing them that, hey, you know, this this public road that runs through it. It needs to be turned to private. We'll take over maintenance of it. So we got a road built for free. You know, then we looked at how do you set up the units? What are you using it for here? What's the highest and best use? And really what we were able to do was we were able to come up with something that provided a 39% return to my investors over a period of 15 months and things that were able to really make sense to them in a slow moving train that brought it to fruition, brought it to completion, and brought it to an exit above expectations, and really put it in a sense that at the end of the day, everybody was able to get what they want without having to hurry up and run to catch this stinking thing because it was going to get away with us if we didn't throw $1 million in earnest money at it, right? Mm-hmm. And so in all of that, I prefer to go slow and go accurately, as accurately as possible, rather than just run until you're out of breath and hope you got it. Then once you did, you got to figure out what the hell to do with it.
I like it. And what market was the?
That was Boise, Idaho.
Okay, and your hometown market.
Yeah.
And just to check the boxes, funding it, private investors.
We went with private investing and a commercial bank loan.
Gotcha. We know how you fixed it. You entitled it and built it.
Yep.
Your exit, you told us, I believe 39% internal return. And I tend to ask a lesson or a takeaway from that deal.
You know, the takeaway on that was, you know, always make sure that you've got everything dialed in because we were thinking it was going to be 11 months to build. We ran into some construction delays. We found some piles underground of garbage that had been stashed when the mobile homes were torn down. So, you know, always make sure that you've done more due diligence than you think and make sure that you have a proper contingency. At that time, we were running 5% contingencies. Now we run 7, right? And so we were able to counteract a lot of that stuff and always look at your underwriting. It's got to be solid and it's got to be able to weather unforeseen conditions, right?
Yes. Yeah. So in development, you guys always have like a contingency line and we would stress test our deals that were already constructed. Like, can we sink this thing? Can we kill it? Can we beat it up? You know, let's raise that exit cap. Let's raise that discount rate. Let's beef up the renovation cost. Does it still work? Yeah. And that's essentially what we're still doing today. But to your point, it's critical. Yeah. All right. We got, three closing questions for you, Shannon. First one is about, resources. You have a real estate or business book that you recommend to the audience.
You know, the one I like, but Chris Voss's book, Never Split the Difference. Number one, I love how it's a story about how he was an FBI negotiator, and then he applies it to business. But there's so many of those things that are true. I just used the how do you expect me to do that in some negotiations just last week, and it worked magnificently. So that's a great one for me.
I love that. I had what was it? He might have been on Lex Fridman, but Chris Voss was. I listened to him talk about that. I think it was Lex Fridman's podcast, and I was like, "Oh my god, this guy and his voice." You know what I mean? You're like,
"Yeah,
I wouldn't want to mess with this guy."
I had lunch with him, and he's just eyeballing you, and you know he's just taking you apart inside, right? You just.
That's awesome. A personal development book that you'd recommend?
You know, personal development I think is definitely something that has to be ongoing. But you know, a lot of my personal development is focused around mindset because if your mindset, I mean, look, call it God, the universe, whatever you're throwing out there is going to come back to you. So if you can't control your mindset and continue to see that in this pile of crap, there's got to be a pony somewhere, you're going to get beat up and you're going to get trashed. Right now, I can't name a mindset book that is good for that, but I do a lot of meditation. Just to get my mind clear so that I'm focusing and hitting the day clear-minded and positive directed.
No, that's a very fair answer. And I think – I can't remember exactly where I heard it, but an entrepreneur is trying to maintain I like this word, an invincible mindset. It's not that things aren't happening. I mean, things could be falling apart all around you.
That's what you're paid for, right? Yeah. You're a paid problem solver, and the minute you think that these problems are going to overwhelm you, you've tackled too much.
I love it. All right. This is when I pass over the metaphorical coach's clipboard and you get to call the play. What's your single best coaching point for aspiring entrepreneurs?
You know, be important to important people, right? They say that you are the sum of your 5 closest friends. You're the sum of the people in the room. Always being the dumbest person in the room and be important to those people, right? Learn from them by being able to find a way to be of service to them. Because then they'll owe you one, and having somebody that knows what you want to know owe you is a whole lot better than knowing the janitor from the high school, owe you one from 20 years ago and trying to collect on that and do something amazing with it, right? No offense to janitors, but you know.
No, I hear you. And that was very tangible. I like that. All right. Last thing, where can people find you, connect you, learn a little bit more about you?
Easiest place to do that is at ShannonRobnett.com.
ShannonRobnett.com.
All my social media handles are there. My calendar's there. We can have a 15-minute call, see what we can do for you, see if maybe some of the stuff we're doing fits. You can find my podcast, newsletter, all that stuff is right there.
That's awesome. Shannon, you've been an incredible guest, and I'm not just saying that. Really, really enjoyed this. Everybody, I'm sure you enjoyed this episode. Please give us a follow, a rate, and review. Share this episode with a friend. Shannon just dropped a ton of information on you guys, a unique guest with unique background. If you're into the socials, be sure to follow us at Yield Coach on Insta, Facebook, and YouTube. We frequently post about deal opportunities, bonus content, and inside looks into personal and professional pursuits. But for all of us now, that is a wrap on this show. I'm your coach, Ian Brown, signing off and reminding everyone to lace up and leave it all on the field. Yield Coach out. All right, Shannon, man, you are top notch.
Good buddy.
Top notch. I saw your one pager and I was, yeah, you're good.
Thanks,
we'll get
man.
All the raw files. We'll get everything to you.
Awesome.
Appreciate you. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yep.